Okay, so before we get into the teaching this morning, the big question has been, what are we doing now that Matthew, the study of Matthew, has been completed? There are a few things that are going to happen. First of all, since Robin and I are going to be going to South Africa in March for about 3 weeks, it'll be effectively the next day after Catherine's bat mitzvah, we'll be heading down. And we'll be visiting our dear friends down in South Africa. We're looking forward to seeing them all again. And hi, South Africa. Everybody say hi to South Africa. There you go. Wonderful folks. So what we're going to do is between now and then, we're going to do some studies in the Psalms. This has been like a personal project of mine over the last 6 months or so. And if you've been coming to the prayer service right before the study, the prayer leaders have been taking a psalm each week, and we've been praying through it and meditating on it. And so we're going to start just using some of those in the study time. I'm going to be doing two psalms today and the next few weeks. And then when I'm gone, my brother Brian will be filling in, doing a psalm. Tim Pell will be filling in. And also Pastor Jim Jurgen, he's sitting right back there. And his wife, hi Karen, good to see you. And Jim will be filling in for us. Then when we get back from South Africa, I've been asked to do a study on Colossians. So I'm going to try to do this in 4 weeks, or four chapters. I'm really going to try to do all of Colossians in 4 weeks. And then what's going to happen after that is this. People have been asking me to do more writing. You know, I got that one book out like 20 years ago. I've had others in the works, but it's like writing is such a chore for me. It is just, anguish. And it takes a lot of time. I'm not a gifted writer. It's just plain hard work. And so it's like I have a choice. I can teach at Beth Dacoon or I can write. You guys come first. Besides, I like teaching. I hate writing. So it's a no-brainer. But people have been asking, when's the next book coming out? And God has been just prompting my heart to do more writing. And so my brilliant wife and lovely wife had a great idea. She says, why don't you do your writing and then just share with us each week what you've been working on during the week? And it's like, duh, there it is. And what I want to do is I've really been for a few years now wanting to do a messianic commentary on the Torah. Not getting into all so many technicalities, as a lot of Torah commentaries do, but make it more meditative, something that brings out pictures of Messiah, things that will feed the soul. There are a lot of things out there that feed the intellect, and I want something that feeds the heart and soul. And, you know, I've got notes from teaching through the Torah so many times. I've got these three-ring binders, fat binders, just all in a row. All my notes are there. So it's a matter of going through there and basically putting them in some kind of an order and then printing them. So I'm going to be working on that. Robin thinks it's going to take 5 years. I have no idea how long it's going to take. It could be much less. It could be longer. But I passed this idea past the elders. I ran it past them, and they were all in agreement. They thought it was a great idea. I bounced it off a few other people here. They all liked the idea. So I'm hoping the rest of you like the idea, because I don't know how else to do both things. And is that okay with you if we do that? Oh, wow. Okay. Well, this better be good, huh? All right, so when we finish Colossians, that's what we'll do. We'll be out of total sync. We'll be totally out of sync with the Torah reading schedule. We'll be starting in Genesis in April or May sometime. But that's okay. It'll be a great ride, I promise. Okay. Well, today we're going to look at two psalms, Psalm 67 and 72. I shared about Psalm 67 back during Hanukkah, during the prayer service. But I want to bring out some of those insights with you. It's an incredible psalm, an amazing psalm. It's called the Menorah Psalm. And then also from the psalm we did this morning, Psalm 72, which is a messianic psalm. So let's just dive right in. There is the menorah, the best we can figure what the golden menorah in the tabernacle and temple looked like. It is based on a description in Exodus 25, And I'm just going to give you a few words of that description in Exodus 25. Verse 31 says, "Then you shall make a menorah of pure gold, and six branches shall go out from its sides." Now, stop that for a second. You might think a menorah has to have branches. But what are you seeing here? Make a menorah of gold. Oh, by the way, have branches going out from it. You see what's happening? All you need for menorah is one branch. All you need is this guy right here in the middle. You need a base, and you need a stalk that will feed the oil up to a wick, and you're good to go. But God says, no, I want this menorah to be special. I want there to be branches going out to the sides. Three branches of the menorah from its one side, and three branches of the menorah from its other side. And see that you make them after the pattern for them, which was shown to you on the mountain. So let's just camp out here for a moment. Let's think about this. Where did the menorah go? It didn't go in the outer courtyard. They had the sun for that. They had the sun, the moon, the stars to provide light in the outer courtyard. But since things generally didn't go on at night, it was the sun. And here's an interesting thing about the sun. The word sun in Hebrew is spelled shin, mem, shin. Notice something interesting? You've got three branches on the right, three branches on the left, and then you've got a mem in the middle, like would be for menorah. That's the sun. But if you go into the tabernacle, the sunlight doesn't get in there very well, so you need an artificial source of light. And that's what we have here, this golden menorah. But if you were to pass through it, the veil, like the high priest did on the Holy of Holies, there's no menorah in there. How did he see? What was the source of light? They said it was the glory of God, the Shekinah of God, the indwelling presence of God, because God is light. So you don't need a light where God is, and the Holy of Holies is where he is, and it was just filled with light. When you go to the other end of the Bible, Revelation talks about the new heavens, the new earth, the new Jerusalem, and says there's no need of the light of the sun or the moon because the glory, the kavod of God, is the light. So the same light the high priest would have seen in the Holy of Holies by God's presence is the same light that will illuminate the entire new heavens and new earth and the days to come. Back to this word Shemesh, by the way. Shemesh means sun, but if you pronounce it Shamish, you don't have to change the spelling, pronounce it differently. Shamish, it means servant. Now think for a second. The sun, it's powerful, it's fearsome, especially if you live in the Middle East. And the sun is necessary on the one hand because it's a servant to the world. Without the sun, there's no life, there's no energy, there are no plants, it's just a dead world. So the sun gives its light to the world, it serves the world. But on the other hand, it's a fearsome thing, you have to protect yourself from it. You can't look directly at it. If you do that, it's painful. If you do it long enough, you go blind. If you're out in it long enough, you'll die. So you need shade. You need to find shadows and shade to be under. This is why when God led the Israelites through the wilderness, he provided a cloud over them in the day to keep them cool. But then there was the pillar of fire at night to provide light for them. So we see the word Shemesh is sun, something to be respected, even feared, stand in awe of, but also means Shamish, a servant. And who said, "I am the light of the world"? That was our Messiah. Is he one to be feared, respected? Is he one to be careful around? Yes, he's the king. He's the lion of the tribe of Judah. But is he also a servant? Yes. He's a source of life for us. You see? See the picture? And see how the Hebrew word, even though I don't write Hebrew very artistically, you can see the balance, the symmetry. A shin on the right with three branches, shin on the left with three branches, the mem, which could also stand for Mashiach, right in the middle. It's amazing stuff. It really is. So let's get rid of that, and we'll go on. Another thing, what is light always a symbol of in the Scriptures? And there are a few right answers here, but they all distill down into one. What does light represent in the Scriptures? Yes? Well, yes, I'm glad you brought that up, because fire and water. By the way, if you're visiting, you're allowed to ask questions and share insights. I'm glad you brought that up. Shin, the two shins, that's called the letter of fire. It even looks like a flame, you know, going up. But mem, it means water. It's the letter of water. And if you've been with us any time at all, you know wherever you find fire and water dwelling together, you have God's presence. Isn't that amazing? You look for places in the Scriptures, there are many of them, where fire and water are at peace with one another. An example. One of my favorites is the hailstones that came down, the seventh plague in Egypt. Hail, this is frozen water. And what was inside the hail? Fire. I mean, that just doesn't happen. You go to the new heavens, or you go to the throne room in Revelation. God's throne is on a sea of glass. It doesn't mean the sea was made out of glass. It means that it was, something happened. Did I press my button or something? Oh, there, I'm back on again. Okay. Don't show Robin how to do that to me. But the sea of glass, it doesn't mean the sea was made out of glass. It means it was so still, there were no ripples. It looked like glass. But there was lightning shooting through it. Fire. Fire and water. This is where God's throne is. And when John sees Yeshua's angel on the island of Patmos, his eyes are like flames of fire, but his voice was like the sound of many waters. Fire and water together. Watch for this. You'll see it everywhere. And even in the word Shemesh, sun, and servant, you find water at the heart of the letters of fire. It's incredible stuff. But what does light represent in Scripture? Truth. Thank you. Somebody got it right off the bat. Truth. It represents a number of things, but all these other things are somehow a subset of the word truth. And truth is spelled Aleph, which is the first letter of the alphabet. And guess what? There's Mem in the middle, again. And Tav, the last letter of the alphabet, over on the left. Emet. Emet. That's the word for truth. And what's really interesting is that the first two letters spell Im, mother. Aleph and Mem spell Im, mother. And Mem and Tav, the second and third letters, spell Mut, death. So the first letter up to the middle of the alphabet spells, that those two letters spelled Im, a mother. And the middle letter, Mem, till the end of the alphabet, Tav, those two letters spell death. And they say to understand truth, to embrace truth, it takes your entire life from mother, from birth, until death. From birth till death. We tend to latch onto a fact and we think we know the truth. All right? There's a difference between facts and truth. Truth is what makes facts factual. You can have all the facts and still miss the truth. So these are just a few things I want you to think about, but I want you to focus on this, though. This is so extremely important. God told Moses, you make the menorah like the pattern you saw on the mountain. The materials come out of the earth. The gold comes out of the earth. But the instructions on how to form the gold come from the heavenlies. And when you put the two together, this is what you wind up with. A tabernacle, and you have this menorah. And God wants to teach us something. His truth is always symmetrical. His truth is always balanced. It's always balanced. And when you hear truth, but it seems out of balance, then it probably is out of balance. It's a half-truth. And remember, a half-truth is a whole lie. And what would happen? Think for a moment. What if we were to cut off one of these arms? Would it still stand? Maybe. You cut off two arms, three arms on one side, eventually it's going to topple over. Over it goes. So the arms that stick out to one side require the arms on the other side So this thing could be at rest. It could be at balance. It can sit. Because you see, a lot of people's menorahs look like this. They have to struggle and strain to hold up their version of the truth. There are plenty of examples of this. Here's one what everybody talks about. Calvinism. God is sovereign and we have no free will. Calvinism. And can you prove that God is absolutely, totally, completely sovereign from Scripture? You sure can. But a Calvinist lives his life like this. He's always trying to prop up his Calvinism. On the other hand, you have Arminianism, which believes God is not sovereign. We have complete free will. Everything's up to us. And their menorah looks like that. Okay? Can you prove Arminianism? Can you prove that we have free will from the Scriptures? Absolutely. So what is the truth? The truth is this. God is absolutely, totally sovereign, and we have free will. Deal with it. Well, I don't understand how those two things can be. You don't have to understand it. It doesn't command you to understand it. It just says it's so. So deal with it. And when you deal with it, when you embrace both, it's like, it just rests on its bottom. It's at peace. There's shalom. I don't have to struggle and strain. You know, you can usually tell people who have balanced truth, they don't have to talk so much. But people whose menorahs are all tipping, they have to talk about it all the time. That's how they prop it up. They have to keep convincing you that their version of truth is right, because that way you'll help them prop up what they believe in. You understand? And we could give so many examples of this through Scriptures, but practice, learn this. Learn that truth is a balanced, symmetrical thing. And what's amazing is even when you focus in on one thing, let's say you focus in just on one of these cups, guess what? When you look at one of these cups, it's still symmetrical. When you look at the detail of truth, you focus in, you still see symmetry wherever you go. That's the amazing thing about God's truth. When you back out, you see balance and symmetry. When you focus in, you see balance and symmetry. And God is light. He is light. You know, in Genesis, it doesn't say God created the light. It says, Vayomer Elohim Yehi Or. Light is. Vayehi Or. Light was. He is the light. He didn't have to create light. It says he forms the light and creates the darkness. Now, darkness didn't exist. He didn't have to create the light. He just released it out of himself. It was just there. There it is. And then, here's another symmetry. He creates the light on the first day, but then on the fourth day of the week, he creates the vessels for the light, the sun, moon, and stars. Second day, he creates the firmament. And he divides the waters above from waters below. So on the fifth day, the counterpart to that, he creates the fish for the waters below and the birds for the firmament above. Third day, he separates the sea from the dry lands. Sixth day, he has on the dry lands, he's got the grass and the people to occupy it. What he does on one, he completes on the other. The first 3 days, days 4 through 6. And then he made two great lights. He made the sun to rule the day. And he made a smaller light, the moon, to rule the night. And what's amazing, if you can measure the disks of the sun and the moon from the way they look at Earth, they're exactly the same size. Though the sun is many, 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 many times bigger, it's much further away. But from our point of view, and God designed it this way, they look exactly the same size. This is when you have a solar eclipse, the disk of the moon just perfectly, perfectly covers the disk of the sun. And not too big, not too small, perfect symmetry. Okay? It's an amazing thing that God has done. All right. Well, we're not getting to Psalms very quick, are we? But we're made in God's image, right? Do you ever notice you have a left leg, a right leg? Did I say something wrong? Okay, what was that? Okay, am I back on? All right. I never saw you move so fast, Melanie. That was awesome. Okay, anyways, we're back on here. Is everybody awake now? Everybody? All right. As long as there are no cardiac arrests, we're all good. I was saying, I'll say it quietly this time, we're made in God's image, but look, we're symmetrical. Our faces are symmetrical. Arms, legs, everything's symmetrical. Right? Balance, symmetry. Well, let's move on. Turn to Psalm 67, if you would, please. Psalm 67. This is called the Menorah Song. And in fact, in many prayer books, you will see it appear like this, written out in Hebrew as a menorah. Now, these bits at the top here are introductory bits that you'll see in a prayer book. They are not part of the psalm. The psalm begins here. But let me explain what these other bits are. This top line, and you can print this out from the website tomorrow, because I considered printing out copies of this for you to take notes on, but I thought, if you're interested, you'll print it off the internet. And then you can, if you have to, you can listen to this again and kind of jot down things on your printout. This top line says, Dalifne miata omed. It means, it's a quote from the Talmud, I believe. It says, know before whom you stand. Lifne melech, before the king. Malkei hamlachim, the king of kings. And then it's got this little acrostic here. It's got four letters. And you see like this little parentheses. That means it's an acrostic. And those four letters represent Hashem, Kadosh, Baruch, Hu. The Lord, the Holy One, blessed is He. Okay? So know before whom you stand. The King of Kings, holy is He. And then down here, you've got three short lines on the right, and that's Hebrew, and I think this says the same thing, but this is, I believe, is Aramaic. Aramaic uses Hebrew letters, so I don't read Aramaic, but the little bit I can make out looks like it's the same thing. So you have Hebrew on the right, Aramaic on the left. And it says, basically, faithful are the perfect words or commandments of the praised one, the one who is praised. Adon HaKol, the Lord of all. And then I want you to look closely here. Who was, who is, and who will be. Haya, Hove, Vayyeh. There are only three letters used here. You got Hays, Yuds, and Vavs. All the forms of Hebrew for the word to be is made up of combinations of hey, yud, and vav. Now here's God's name, right? In the middle, the big fat letters. You have a yud, a hey, a vav, and a hey. This is why we don't know how to translate His name. Does it mean I am, I was, I will be? Does it just mean is? I think that's probably the best translation of God's name, is. But we do know this, His name is a verb. His name is a verb. This is why learning His name means you're trying to learn a moving target. Because He is, He was, He will be. To know Him, it takes a lifetime. And anyone who says, well, I know His name, well, that means, yeah, you can spell it, but you know the name is the character. And this character is alive. He's the beer. We're the beings. He is the one, the source of all life. To truly know Him. I mean, this is why David prays and others pray, teach me your name. They knew how to spell it, but they wanted to know the one who the name pointed to. Now, these words here in bold say this, Shaviti, Yad Hei Vav Hei, we say Adonai. That's what the little white letters inside the big black letters spell. The white letters are Adonai. We say Adonai because we don't know how to pronounce God's name, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. So, Shaviti Adonai Lenegdi Tamid. This is a quote from Psalms. It says, I have set Adonai before me always. But I want you to notice something. Even with this, there's symmetry. Because Shaviti is five letters. Lenegdi, five letters. But Adonai is four letters. Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, four letters. Tamid, four letters. And this way of opening this psalm and prayer books is very ancient. And it's introduction to Psalm 67 itself. So hopefully you've had plenty of time to get to Psalm 67. And I'm going to give produce a slightly larger version of it there. Good, it all fits on the screen pretty much, does it? There we go, how's that? Okay. So here's how it's set up. Psalm 67 has seven verses. Those seven verses are the seven arms of the menorah. Verse 1, verse 2, verse 3, verse 4 is the one long in the middle, verse 5, verse 6, and verse 7. Now this bit across the top is the attribution. Because in Psalm 67, it says, to the chief musician, a psalm with instrumental music, a song. In Hebrew, it's Lamnatzeach ben Ginut. You know, a nigun is a melody. Ben Ginut, Mizmor Shir. And what they've done, they've taken that and not put natural spaces where they normally are, but they've broken it up into groups of letters. Three letters, three letters, three letters, two, three, three, three. Again, they're even moving the spaces between the words so that we have this symmetry. Now here's where it gets really interesting. This is really fun. Verse 1 has exactly seven words. Look at the mind over there. This, but verse 1 has exactly seven words. I'll erase the verse numbers. You can figure the verses out. Has seven words. Okay, seven words. The last verse, go way over onto the right-hand side, verse 7 also has seven words. So the two arms are in balance. Verse 2 has six words, and so does its counterpart, verse 6. Six words. You can count them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, right on down. Verse 3 has six words. So does verse 5. In fact, verses 3 and 5 are exactly the same. Okay, if you look at the word right here, it's exactly the same as the word there. Amim and Amim. Elohim, Elohim. Verses 3 and 5 are exactly identical. Okay, did you catch that? And then you need to have a long stalk in the middle. So in the middle, you've got a verse with 11 words. And the way this works is you go down the stalk, and then when you get to the end, you come around from the right and finish up with the base. So obviously, the author of this song had a menorah in mind. Because this kind of balance does not happen by accident. And from the early days, when people would read the psalm, they called it the menorah psalm, because everything is such perfect, perfect symmetry. Now, the menorah has seven arms, three on one side, three on the other, and then there's the middle. This has seven arms, and 7 times 7 is 49. Guess how many words are in the psalm? Exactly 49 words, 7 times 7. Another example of perfect balance. Again, verses 3 and 5 are identical. If you take the first letter of each verse, let me erase things, because I just don't want things to get too cluttered up here. If you take the first letter of each verse, I'm doing these backwards, and you take their numerical values, it adds up to the number 72, which equals chesed, which is loving kindness. And as you read the content of this psalm, you'll see that it's so much loving kindness here, and it's an amazing psalm. We'll look at the English in just a moment. The middle word of this psalm is the word peoples. It's right here. It's near the base of the middle stalk, the word Amim. Amim. And what's interesting, Yeshua's name always is found right at the base of the second verse. Yeshua Techa. And if you go on Google, you can find all kinds of versions of this Psalm 67 with menorahs. Some are very artsy and beautiful calligraphy, but you'll always see Yeshua and the Amim being right next to each other, the middle word, and you see Yeshua coming right in to the peoples. And what is this psalm about? Well, let's read it. In fact, I'm going to give you a little bit of a glimpse into my Bible. This is what I look at. I mark up my Bible. I mark the Dickens out of my Bible. I encourage you to do the same. I remember when Robin was little, she had a Bible that was her dad's, Jim's. And Jim, I don't know if you remember this, but you had written in the cover of that Bible, "Mark the Bible and it will mark you." And that stuck in my mind. And I've marked my Bible ever since then. But use pencil and don't underline everything. Try to find a way of marking your Bible so you don't have to underline everything. Pretty soon you have it all underlined. You have to start over. And this is what I did. I took the seven verses and I made a little menorah off to the side. But let's analyze this. Verse 1, God be gracious to us and bless us. Now who is writing, Jews or Gentiles? Jews. These are Jews, all right? This is the book of Psalms. This is a Hebrew Bible. Be gracious to us and bless us and cause his face to shine upon us. Sounds like the Aaronic blessing, doesn't it? But let's follow that on around to its balancing arm. Verse 7. God blesses us. Why? That all the ends of the earth may fear him. You know, the Jewish people are the chosen people, but they're chosen for something. He chose one group of people, not so he could just ignore everybody else, but so he could reach everybody else. You understand? And he has blessed this people, and he has guided this people, and disciplined and punished this people, and given his word to this people, and redeemed this people, and brought them back to himself. He's done all these things so that all the ends of the earth may fear him. I've never read any books by Anne Rice, who did Interview the Vampire and all the vampire books. Just not interested. She must be a really good author because her books have made her millions and millions and millions of dollars. But I was in a used bookshop here back in the summer, and I saw a biography. I don't know a biography of her. And it was said, the title, I believe, was Returning to the Light. And I thought, Returning to the Light? Did something happen? So I picked it up, read the fly leaf. And she talked about how she'd been raised Catholic as a little girl, and in her teens she had completely turned back on God, became an atheist, started writing these vampire books and everything, but then later rediscovered her faith. Now, I don't know where she's at today, but I thought, this is interesting. I want to read this story. And so I bought the book, and I found it fascinating as she described her life and how she had turned from God, but then she came back. But the thing that really intrigued me, you know why she began to rebuild her faith in God? She said it was the Jewish people. She said she couldn't explain the Jews. And she had a neighbor, neighbors who were Orthodox Jews when she was young, and they befriended her and said they're the kindest, most loving, most generous people, wise people. So that left a mark on me. And even when her years as an atheist, the Jewish people kept ringing in her soul. And when she'd see the history of their nation, there's just no way they could still exist today and accomplish what they accomplished and do what they do unless God was blessing them and using them to reach the ends of the earth. It's pretty amazing. I'm not endorsing Anne Rice's books. I haven't read them. I don't care to read them. But her autobiography I found fascinating. Well, let's do this now. Let's go over to verse 6. The earth has yielded its produce. Our God blesses us. There's that blessing again. And let's follow it on back to verse 2. That your way may be known on the earth, your Yeshua among all the nations. Okay, verse 6. The earth has yielded its produce. God, our God, blesses us that your way may be known on the earth, your Yeshua among all the nations. So you can read this straight through from verse 1 to 7, or you can just start playing games going back and forth along the arms. It's meant to be read both ways. Now let's go to verse 3. Verse 3, let the peoples praise you, O God. Let all the peoples praise you. Now verse 5 is exactly the same. Let the peoples praise you, O God. Let all the peoples praise you. Who are the peoples? Those are the Gentiles. But they're right in the middle, you have the longest verse, 11 words in Hebrew. And what does it say? Let the nations be glad and sing for joy, for you will judge the peoples. Amin. That is the middle word. It's one word in Hebrew. That's the very center word of the entire song. For you will judge the peoples with uprightness and guide the nations of the earth. Now let's count these. Verses 1 and 7 have to do with the Jews, asking God's blessing and saying God has blessed. The verse 2, that your way may be known on the earth, your salvation among all the nations. The goyim is the word in Hebrew. Let the peoples praise you, O God. Let all the peoples praise you. Let the nations be glad and sing for joy. For you will judge the peoples with uprightness and guide the nations on the earth. Let the peoples praise you, O God. Let all the peoples praise you. The earth is yields produce. God, our God blesses us. God blesses us that all the ends of the earth may hear him. What is this about? It's about the Jewish people and their God, and how their God blesses them. But what's the purpose of all this blessing intents of the Jews? To reach all the people in the world. This is light. You understand why they made this according, the author made this according to Menorah? This is God's light. This is God's symmetry. Bringing light to the nations. He brought forth the Jewish people to be a light to the nations. He sent Messiah to be light to the Jewish people. And Yeshua spoke to his disciples, says, you're the light of the world. Light everywhere, sending light out. And the core of it is Messiah through Israel, through the Gentiles, to the ends of the earth. What an amazing, incredible song. And I just encourage you to spend more time camped out at this song, because it really is amazing how these 49 words can pack such a punch and have so much going on within them. There have been articles written about this psalm, and I encourage you to look them up, and you'll find them in books and on the internet and so on. But the Menorah Psalm, fantastic piece of literature there, is it? Let's go to Psalm 72. Psalm 72 is a messianic psalm. I call it the Messianic Kingdom. That's what I've entitled it in my Bible. And if you look at Psalm 72, look at the attribution, which comes right before verse 1. The attribution says a psalm of Solomon, but Solomon did not write this psalm. It really should be translated a psalm for Solomon. It was written by David. The way we know this, go to the last verse. Verse 20 says, the prayers of David, the son of Jesse, are ended. So, what we figure is that when the psalms are being arranged, and probably Solomon is the one who arranged the psalms in their present order, he took all the psalms that were well known by David and the ones that had been popularized, and he put them all in inside the first 72 psalms, and he ended with this one, which is a psalm David wrote for his son Solomon. But then, Psalm 73, 4 and 5 and on, these are psalms of Asaph. You find psalms written by Moses, psalms written by other people, sons of Korah, mixed through here. But as you go through the next 78 psalms, you're going to find that there are 17 more by David. And the only thing we can figure is after the first 72 were arranged, they found some more. And they thought, oh, let's add those in, okay? And they found some odds and ends of Psalms of David that they included. But in verse 20, Solomon, or whoever arranged these, said, okay, this is the end of David's Psalms. His Psalms have been completed. Now, if we just go through this fairly quickly, you'll see this describes this incredible kingdom. It was the kingdom that that David prayed for his son Solomon, whose name, Shlomo, means peace. Solomon was the son of David, the king. But everything David wanted for his son Solomon, hidden behind it, is foreshadowing of the son of David, Yeshua, Messiah, the king. And what he was praying for Solomon is a picture of what will be fulfilled through Messiah and his kingdom. So you can read it on those two levels. But everything about this psalm, you don't see warfare and battles, you see peace. You see prosperity. You see things turned right side up. It says, give the king your judgments, O God, and your righteousness to the king's son. May he judge your people with righteousness, and you're afflicted with justice. Let the mountains bear peace to the people, the hills in righteousness. May he vindicate the afflicted of the people. Save the children. That word save is the root of Yeshua. Save the children of the needy and crush the oppressor. And then he says something very strange. In most translations, it's worded this way: let them fear you while the sun endures and as long as the moon throughout all generations. So he's talking about the sun and moon. Remember the menorah? Light, God put the sun and the moon. Sun ruled the day and moon ruled the night. So he mentions the sun and moon together in one verse, verse 5. But go up to verse 7. In his days may the righteous one or the righteous man flourish and abundance of peace till the moon is no more. Then go down to verse 17. May his name endure forever. May his name increase as long as the sun shines. So moon and sun are mentioned together in verse 5. Then the moon by itself in verse 7. But it says, may his peace endure, abundance of peace till the moon is no more. In verse 17, may his name increase as long as the sun shines. Very odd stuff. Very odd stuff. So what's going on? Well, first of all, righteousness. One of the things we know is that it'll be a righteous kingdom. In those days, Jeremiah says in chapter 33, in those days and at that time I will cause a righteous branch of David to spring forth, and he shall execute justice. Justice is talked about there at the beginning of this psalm. And righteousness, there's righteousness again on the earth. In those days Judah shall be saved, Jerusalem shall dwell in safety. And this is the name by which he shall be called, Adonai Tzidkenu, which means Adonai is our righteousness. Jeremiah 33 is describing the messianic kingdom. And I think he might be drawing from Psalm 72. But I want you to look at that verse 5, that mysterious, odd verse 5. Let them fear you while the sun endures as long as the moon throughout all generations. Terrible translation. But see, if you translate it literally, it doesn't make any sense. Translate it literally, it's Im Shemesh. Here's our word Shemesh, sun, with the sun. Ulifne, velifne, and in the face of, or in front of, or facing, Yareach, the moon. So here is sun, and here is moon. Im Shemes, ulifne Yareach, with the sun and before the moon. There it is. With the sun before. What does that mean? With the sun before the moon. Very mysterious. And the more I search and look, nobody can explain it. I think this stumped the sages, so I feel pretty comfortable being stumped myself. But there's a feeling this gives me. Go back to what we're thinking about the sun and the moon. The sun is fearsome. The sun is something you can't look directly at least for not very long, and you go blind. It's painful. If you stay in the sun too long, especially in the land of Israel, you'll not only get a bad sunburn, you will get sunstroke, you will die. I remember Ray Vanderlaan describing his time in the desert with the shepherds there, just wanting to soak in what shepherd life is like. And there's this little shepherd girl, shepherding her sheep out in the wilderness in the desert. She found this little shrub. It just cast a little area of shadow. So she laid down with her head in the shadow. She had to keep her head cool, because if your brain gets overheated, the whole body begins to shut down. So the rest of her body's in the sun, but she had her head in the shade, because it was part of survival. Sun's a fearsome thing. You can't do without it, but you have to be careful with it. The sun's kind of like God. He's to be feared. But you have to have awe of him. You can't do without him, but you be careful around him. But the moon, on the other hand, is just a mirror. The moon's safe. The moon's not threatening. You can look directly at the moon and just appreciate its beauty. I think someday we'll be able to look at the sun the same way and see it in all of its beauty. But right now we can't. Our eyes aren't strong enough. We have to change first. But we can look at the moon. And so it's saying, with the sun, but into the face of the moon. It's like describing being in between something. Being in between the sun and all of its fearsomeness and all of its awesomeness, but facing the moon, non-threatening. It's like the sun is a picture of God and the moon is a picture of us. Because we just reflect his light. We have no light of our own. We just reflect his light. The sun just stays there. We're the ones who are always moving around. The sun always shines, even though clouds may block it from view, but the moon's always going through phases. You know, since we're the bride of Messiah, we're described as being a woman, as being feminine. Isn't it interesting that a woman's monthly cycle is in cycle with the moon? No biologist can explain that. Why the 28 to 29 days of a woman's cycle and the cycle of the moon happen to line up. But whatever this verse means, there's something quite amazing about it, because if you take the last letter of each word, the mem, the shin, the yud, the chet, it spells Mashiach. No other place in the Bible does that happen. Now you might be saying, well, wait a minute, that mem doesn't look like that mem. They're both mem. Whenever mem is one of the five letters in Hebrew, when it comes at the end of a word, it just changes shape, but it's still a mem, all right? So these are the same letter. So the last letter is im shemesh ulifne yireach, with the sun and before the moon, the last letter spell Mashiach. But things don't end there. If you take the first letters of those four words, the ayin, the shin, the vav, and the yud, they spell Yeshua. Not in order, though. It's yud, and then shin, and then vav, and then ayin. But you have the letters that spell Yeshua. Are you with me on this? So let's kind of review. Psalm 72 is a psalm David wrote for the son of David, whose name means peace. This is also a psalm written for the son of David, the Prince of Peace, King Messiah. And it talks about with the sun before the moon. It's like somehow in between. I'm with the sun, but facing the moon. It's kind of like a picture of Yeshua, who comes from God. There's a divine nature there, but he comes to face the likes of us, the loopy ones, the ones who center ourselves around the world, who can only reflect God's light. We can't produce any light of our own. And those four words that describe this odd position, this unique position, spell Messiah with their end letters and spell Yeshua with their initial letters. No other place in the Bible has anything like this happened. But then in verse 7 it says, in his days may the righteous one flourish in abundance of peace till the moon is no more. What does it mean the moon is no more? Nowhere in the Bible does it say the moon ceased to exist. It does tell us in Revelation that you won't need the light of the sun or the moon, because the glory of God will be the light of the city. So the moon's still there. But how is it today? You know, oftentimes the moon is out during the day, but you don't notice it. Because when the sun comes up, you don't even notice the moon. When you do see it, it just looks like a chalky thumb smudge up in the sky somewhere. But at night is when you really notice it. And he's given us the job of producing and providing light, rather, in the darkness of this present age. But when the Son of Righteousness arises with healing in his wings, we won't need our light anymore. And somehow the sun and the moon come back together. The Messiah and his bride, we could become one together. But our job as providing light in the darkness is over, because there's no more darkness. It just isn't there anymore. And in verse 17, the New American Standard says, may his name endure forever, may his name increase as long as the sun shines. English Standard Version says, may his name endure forever, his fame continue as long as the sun. But the Complete Jewish Bible follows Jewish tradition, says, may his name endure forever, his name is Yunon. How did he get that, huh? Yunon Shemo, Yunon is his name. This word increase is a word that they say is really a name of the Messiah. It's one of Messiah's names, Yunon. And it looks like this, Yunon. And this is another example where this letter and this letter, the last letter, are the same letter. They're both letters, Nun, but at the end of a word, Nun stands up straight, shapes up. But they're both the same letter. And the letter Nun has a numerical value of 50. But the sages point out that if you replace the 50 with a letter that equals 5, you come up with Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. And they say this is the name of Messiah, who bears the image of the Holy One, Adonai himself. Who knows? I want to close with a few passages, and then we'll be done. Isaiah 60, verses 19 to 20. No longer will you have the sun for light by day, nor for brightness will the moon give you light. But you will have Adonai for an everlasting light, and your God for your glory. Your sun will set no more, neither will your moon wane. See, they're still there. But the glory of God is the light. For you will have Adonai for an everlasting light, and the days of your mourning will be finished. And then John, he gives us his vision of Revelation, new heavens and new earth, the new Jerusalem, and the last chapter, Revelation 21, 23, 25. And the city has no need of the sun or the moon to shine upon it, for the glory of God has illumined it. And its lamp is the Lamb. And the nations shall walk by its light, and the kings of the earth shall bring their glory into it. And in the daytime, for there shall be no night there, its gates shall never be closed. Now this word for glory is the word, the root word, the verb form is the word kabed. We use the word kavod for glory. Interesting thing about the word kabed, this glory. This is the glory of God that illuminated the Holy of Holies. Remember we were talking about that earlier? Holy of Holies, God's presence just illuminated everything. And that's what illuminates the new heavens, new earth, the new Jerusalem. And I'm not big on gematria, but this is kind of interesting. Kaf equals 20, Bet equals 2, Dalet equals 4, or 2 squared. Everything's in some form of 2. But what happens if you add all that up? It equals 26, right? That's the number of God's name, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, 26. And his glory, his presence, he is light. And if you're wondering, Grant, where are you going with this? I have no idea. I'm just, you know, this is one of those teachings that doesn't really have a point. It's almost, the way I feel as I've been looking at this, it's like sunbathing. It's like going out in the light and just, especially in a winter day, just feeling the warmth of God's light. That's kind of how these passages speak to me. It's just like, wow, this is amazing what God has put in his word. Revelation 22:5, which is the last chapter of Revelation. And there shall no longer be any night, and they shall not have need of the light of a lamp, nor the light of the sun, because the Lord God shall illumine them, and they shall reign forever and ever. 1 Corinthians 15:41, there's one glory of the sun, and there another glory of the moon, and another glory of the stars. And the Greek word that Paul uses here is the word glory. Why do you use the glory? Why didn't he say size or brightness or some other thing? He uses the word glory. Why? Because God's glory will be the light of the world and the kingdom to come. For right now, we have the glory of the sun, the glory of the moon, glory of the stars. But when God's glory comes, we'll realize, oh, these are only samplings of that glory. These are only bits, sparks, splinters of the light of which he is the source. And then 1 Corinthians 13:12. For now we see in a mirror dimly. The moon's just a mirror. Our understanding of the scriptures is a mirror. Our thinking, the images we have in our mind of God and Messiah and the world to come are just shadows. They're vague images, reflections. But then, face to face. Ah. I wonder if Paul somehow had Psalm 72 in mind, where it talks about in the face of the moon. And then later down at the end of the chapter says, in the face of the sun, lifnei shemesh, in the face of the sun. But later we'll see face to face. Now I know in part, but then I shall know fully, just as I also have been fully known. Can you imagine knowing God as well as he knows you? Can you even begin to fathom that? I feel like I hardly know him, because he's so great and I'm so small. But I've got an eternity ahead of me. And I won't have the distractions of this physical limitations of this body. But someday to know him as well as he knows me. See, that's what marriage is. It's getting to know a spouse as well as they know you. With me, I know it's the women always understand men. It's the men who will never understand the wife. But in this case, it's God who understands us. It's like eventually, maybe we'll finally understand him. I don't know. But we have a glorious future ahead of us. And I think these two Psalms, 67 and 72, give us a little hint of what that glorious future is of his kingdom. I think it's something we can return to over and over and over again. Yes, Tony, I see your hand up.
I don't know if it was you.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. You have to get a microphone. There you go.
But I was shown that the menorah, the center candlestick represents Yeshua.
Mm-hmm.
And one side represents Israel before, and the other is after. And he brings them together to become one.
Well, you know, I thought that, but it doesn't quite work out that way. The first branch and the seventh branch of Psalm 67 are both Israel. It talks about us, God's blessing us. But in the middle are the nations. It's kind of opposite of what you'd think it to be. One other thing, it's interesting. According to the sages and the Hebrew commentators, when you read through that section in Exodus describes the menorah, they count up all the features that describe all the parts of the menorah, and they come up with the number 42. Well, someone has observed, you go to Psalm 67, you count all the white spaces between the words. You have 42 white spaces between the words. So even there, all the parts of the menorah add up to 42. You have 49 words, but they create 42 white spaces in between the words. Again, the symmetry. There are other things to share from that psalm, but it gets into a lot of detail. But amazing, amazing, creative piece of work. Only someone who's truly inspired by God could ever produce Psalm 67 or 72 or any of them. But any other last-minute comments? Did I leave you with your heads kind of spinning on this one? Because I know mine is. Yours should, too, I think. But yes, Joel.
In Psalm 72, instead of translating it, Shemesh.
Yes. I'm sure you could.
For the moon part of it, Is there another translation of the word for moon, or the word for these Hebrew letters?
Yareach is the word for moon. There are several plays on words for Yareach in this psalm. I marked a few of them in my Bible, but not all of them, but there are some plays on words there. There are. But I didn't take enough notes to really comment on them too much. But you will find words that are made to sound like Yareach or various spellings of the word Yareach. You find it scattered through here. Yeah. So that will set you to studying right there. I hope I'm whetting your appetite to study these psalms more yourself. Yes, Jim. Oh, let's get the microphone there. Thank you, Tim.
I had to ask this because it really doesn't seem pertinent. But there have been days when I've seen both the sun and the moon in the sky. Mm-hmm. Is there significance?
Yeah. It's just when you do see them together, is the moon very bright? Very noticeable? No. In fact, most of the times the moon is in the sky in the day, you don't notice it at all. And that's what verse 7 is, until the moon is no more. In other words, when the sun's out, you just don't even hardly notice the moon. Yeah. He must increase and I must decrease. That's the principle. Okay, Robin. Does Robin have a comment?
Yes. Verse of our last study this mainstream is beauty, mm-hmm. and how the surface beauty is deceitful.
Yeah.
So we're looking into the meaning of real beauty.
Yeah.
And it's so cool because the definition of Tiferet, of course, mm-hmm. or Tiferet, is balance and harmony.
Yes.
And I've been thinking about that word a lot in the verse, worship the Lord in the beauty.
Yes. Yeah, there, Robin's alluding to there are several Hebrew words for pretty or beautiful, and yafa is one of the most common. But there's a word, teferet, which happens to start and end with the same letter, teferet. But it's a beauty that comes from symmetry. All right? The beauty comes from perfect balance. And teferet is one of the mystical words they say is a name of Messiah. So, because he had such perfect balance, didn't he? He balanced everything so absolutely perfectly. He knew how to be as gentle as a lamb, but he knew how to make a whip, flip over tables, and drive people out. He could do both. Lamb, lion, but he's always in balance. He knew when to be the one, when to be the other. Never misstepped once. Perfect teferet. Yeah, so. Well, this is a good time to close before the microphones blow up again. I hear some buzzing sounds, so they might be ready to go off. So let's close. Father, I thank you so much for your word. And this is one of those cases where we read your words and stand in awe of them. For we can't understand them fully and completely, but we can look at them and see such beauty. So, Father, I pray that you'll just give us eyes to behold the beauty of your word. Give us more of an appetite for your light. May our lives be beautiful. May they be balanced and symmetrical. May we know when to speak, when to be quiet. May we know when to do and when just to be. Know when to pray, know when to act. Know when to exercise power and strength, and then when just to absorb pain and hurt. Lord, we so messed up so many times. But your word is like a two-edged sword, a weapon that is perfectly symmetrical. And it says that it divides asunder the soul and the spirit. So, Father, help us to know what comes out of the restlessness of our own souls, our minds, our wills, our emotions. And then what comes from your spirit, that which is true and steadfast and always right. Help us to see what is what. and help us to become the people you want us to be, people more like Yeshua, balanced and true, and make us the lights that this dark world needs. And we ask this in the name of the light of the world himself, Yeshua HaMashiach. Amen.